What are hormones and what is a hormonal imbalance?
Hormones are these chemical messages in the body. And I think of them like text messages. They tell different parts of the body to do something. There's five ways that the body communicates with itself. Hormones, first and foremost, peptides, proteins, nutrients, and the genome. We want to be working with these different systems and not against them. So what is hormone imbalance? It's when this exquisite state of homeostasis in the body gets out of balance. And so that can happen in women with endometriosis or polycystic ovary syndrome. It can happen in men with low testosterone. It can happen with your cortisol if you're someone who's chronically stressed and you're not attending to it. So there's ways that hormones get out of balance, but there's also ways to easily get back into a state of homeostasis.
What are some of the most common ways that we end up with a hormonal imbalance that you see in the modern day?
Well, I would say stress is number one. So we've got this stress response system, and I think a lot of people consider stress sort of this feeling, but the truth is,
welcome to Pod Summarizer. Visit our website and summarize your favorites podcasts.
You can measure stress. You can measure your cortisol. You can do it in the blood in the morning. You can also measure it at 4 points during the day and look at your stress response to see if there's a way that it's getting pulled out of balance. There's lots of ways to deal with that, but I would say measurement is really critical. So that's one piece. Another is genomics. So some people have a greater risk of developing something like polycystic ovary syndrome, where you've got too much androgen or testosterones. There's also hormone imbalances that are related to other sex hormones, like your testosterone, your estrogen, your progesterone. It can lead to infertility, can lead to acne and other problems.
Do we have the tools to measure stress at home, or do we have to go take a test?
No, you can do it at home. So I usually start by doing it at a lab, because I think working with a clinician who's knowledgeable about hormones is the best way to begin. Otherwise, you're getting all this information, you may not know what to do with it. But increasingly, we're disintermediating the medical system, because I would say the medical system has really failed a lot of people with hormone imbalances. And so testing can be a valuable way to do, to look at it at home, in addition to what you can get at the lab.
And what are you learning at the lab? Like, what are they testing? What chemicals are they seeing? What are you hoping to see? Is it a percentage scale? Is it a rating of 1 out of 10? Where are we trying our stress to land throughout the day?
It depends on what hormone you're measuring. So when it comes to stress, cortisol is the main stress hormone. But there's others too, like DHEA. So what we're looking for, if you measure a blood cortisol in the morning, you want it to be about 10 to 15. That's the optimal range, which is different than the normal range. So normal is what we tend to use in mainstream medicine. It's what I was taught to use. But I don't necessarily want to be like the average American. I want to be in a more optimal state. So that's the optimal state. If you measure it in the afternoon, it's more like you want your level to be about 5 to 10. So that's what we want with cortisol. DHEA and other hormones often vary depending on age. So generally with DHEA, I like to see more than 100 in women, more than 150 in men.
Got it. And if you're seeing yourself outside of that 5 to 10 in the morning, I'm assuming above?
We want to see it about 10 to 15 in the morning.
And so above that is negative or below that is bad?
Both.
Both.
So with all hormones, I can't think of a single exception. You want it to be in this Goldilocks zone of not too high and not too low. And when I first started measuring my cortisol, this was in my 30s, I found that it was about 3 times what it should be.
Wow.
So I was someone who was a bit of a stress junkie. I would, you know, I was just sort of used to running on adrenaline and running on cortisol. And so if it's too high, that can be causing too much wear and tear in the body. And if it's too low, that can be a stress response system that has become exhausted.
Understood. And so stress was one of the first ones when we were talking about hormonal imbalance. What was the second?
Well, your sex hormones can get out of balance. Another system that's critical is your metabolic system. So this includes hormones like insulin, glucagon. But insulin is really the star of the show here.
Talk to me about the importance of insulin and the impact that it has. I think we've all heard about it. We may understand a little about it, but not enough.
Yeah, insulin is like the bouncer at a club that determines whether to let glucose into the club or not. So the club here is your cell. If you're someone who has insulin that's working well, it's in that Goldilocks position, fasting of about 5 to 7, then you're letting glucose into the cell. You're able to use it as fuel. You feel good. You're not storing excessive fat. But if you are someone who has insulin resistance, where your cells become numb to insulin, your insulin can climb, and that leads to more fat storage. It leads to glucose not getting into the club. And so the streets are full with glucose. Your bloodstream is full of glucose. And that's where fasting glucose starts to rise. And you can pick that up in a blood test. You can also pick it up on a continuous glucose monitor.
And what's the negative effects of having glucose on the streets?
Well, there's a lot. So having high glucose causes damage to your blood vessels. That's especially important in women because lower levels in the prediabetes range of, you know, somewhere between 100 to 125 can set you up for high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease later on. And that's different than what we see in men. So they tend to have vascular damage at a higher fasting glucose. So I think women especially need to pay attention to this.
What's the difference between hormones for men and women? What are the key differences that you see? Because I think that's, again, something we're not that well-versed in at the moment.
There's a lot of differences. I mean, it's important, first of all, to realize that we all have all of these hormones. Women and men just have different amounts. So if you think of what's classically thought of as a male hormone, testosterone, women have about one-tenth what men have. But still, we're exquisitely sensitive to it. And so we want that Goldilocks zone when it comes to women. With other hormones like estrogen, men make it too. If your estrogen's too low, that can lead to problems with bone loss for men. And then for women, it has about 400 jobs. So it's related to brain health. It's related to memory. It's related to whether you are growing things inside your uterus, like fibroids, endometriosis elsewhere in the body. So you want these hormones to be in a balance. And generally, they vary depending on your sex.
But what are the hormone deficiencies you're seeing in women the most at the moment and in men?
Well, for both men and women, for people who've got a stress response issue, this can start to rob you of some of the sex hormones that you really need to function well. So what I see, especially for people in their 20s, starting around 27 to 28, if you are a high stress person like I used to be, that can lead to problems with falling testosterone. And so increasingly we're seeing low testosterone in men. We can see that in women as well. So it can start as early as your 20s. Other hormone deficiencies or insufficiencies include with your thyroid. So thyroid is one of those hormones that is kind of like the gas pedal. Almost every cell in your body has a receptor for thyroid hormone. And if you're low, then that can lead to fatigue, weight gain, constipation, feeling like you just don't have the energy that you once did. You might lose the outer third of your eyebrows, have hair loss on your head. So that's a common issue that we see in terms of hormone imbalance. Women much more commonly than men. It's about 7 to 9 times more common in women.
As listeners explore the relationship between hormonal imbalances and emotional well-being, the conversation shifts to how these internal factors influence daily life stresses. Next, join the speakers as they discuss practical steps to manage stress and enhance hormonal health amidst external challenges.
As a normal human being who is struggling to deal with work responsibilities, commitments to our partners, challenges with intimacy, someone who's trying to take care of their kids, it already feels like you have so many factors of your exterior world that you're struggling with. You're juggling all of these things. And then at the same time, now you've opened up to us this interior world of all of these other things that we're like, oh yeah, I probably need to figure out my cortisol. And I'm sure there's some insulin stuff I need to work on. And it sounds like I've got too much or too little testosterone, whatever it may be. Like there's almost like this waking up to the fact that all of this exterior difficulty is matched with some sort of interior imbalance. Where would you recommend someone to start if they're starting from zero and thinking, this feels like a lot, it feels overwhelming?
Start with cortisol. There's a few reasons for that. Cortisol is the great unifier because it's involved in all of these other systems. So if you're a high cortisol person, it might be affecting your insulin. It might be dropping your progesterone levels. It could be affecting your testosterone levels as early as your 20s. So I would say start with cortisol. Like the measurement there is critical. And you made an important link here, Jay, between your external world and your inner world. And hormones drive so much of your inner world. The more that you have a sense of the landscape of your inner terrain, the more that you're going to be able to work with it, befriend it, allow these hormones, these messages, these signals to become your friend and not be, you know, some villain that you're blaming for the way that you're feeling.
What are the top three things someone could do today to decrease stress? What should they be focused on?
Well, I would say number one, measure. Like, know what you're dealing with. What you measure improves. So know where you're starting. I think a benchmark is critical. Number two, you know, I started learning yoga from my great-grandmother when I was 5 years old. I started practicing meditation when I was 17 in college. I think there's nothing more effective than meditation and breath work as a way of working with your cortisol. And then number three, I would say there's supplements that can really make a difference. I don't think you can out-supplement a bad diet. I don't think you can out-supplement a stressful life, but you can really work with supplements like phosphatidylserine, very effective at reducing cortisol at a dose of 400 milligrams. Omega-3s, so taking fish oil or a more plant-based source of omega-3s, those are really critical. And then fourth, I would say, look at your relationships. They're often a common source of stress in the body. And a lot of people don't put those things together. So when you've got a relationship with someone that is co-regulating, that allows your nervous system to calm down and reduce your cortisol to that Goldilocks position, that is so effective. There's just a study that got preprinted, so it's not published yet in a peer-reviewed journal, but it's really interesting, Jay. It's about the hassler. People who provide some support but also cause a lot of hassle in your life, and I have a few of those tend to be associated with shortening your life and raising your cortisol. So you want to get a sense of, okay, who are the people that help me stay in hormonal balance? Because the people you surround yourself with can affect your hormones.
One thing I've been reflecting on lately is how even the smallest choices can create a big impact over time. Whether it's choosing to spend a quiet night in to recharge or making a decision that brings you closer to a long-term goal. Those moments of intention really matter. And when it comes to the choices we make with our money, that same mindset applies. I've learned that saving for the things that truly matter, like your first home or a reliable car, starts with small, thoughtful decisions. That's why I appreciate what State Farm is doing with their personal price plan. It gives you the power to personalize your plan and create an affordable price that works for your life. You can bundle your home and auto insurance in a way that supports your journey and your goals. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can choose to bundle and save with the personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state. On eBay, every find has a story. Like if you're looking for a vintage band tee, not just a tee, the band tee from the last show your favorite band ever played. You wore it everywhere, then your best friend started wearing it, which was cute until they unfriended you and took it with them, which was not so cool. Anyway, now you're on eBay and there it is. Same tee from the same tour, still living in your memory, rent-free forever. See, the things you love have a way of finding their way back to you. But eBay isn't just for getting whatever your ex or ex-best friend stole back. It's also for that rare championship foul ball you caught, then heroically gave to the kid next to you. And where else are you going to find your first car? The one you wish you never sold, but now finally get the chance to take back home. For good this time. Shop eBay for millions of finds, each with a story. eBay, things people love.
Does stress you enjoy affect you differently from the stress you don't?
Absolutely.
Okay. Tell me about that.
So we all need stress. And I don't think of stress as a negative word. In medicine and science, we call it eustress. So eustress, EU stress, is a healthy form of stress. It's known as hormesis. It's like a positive intervention on the system of your body. So your body is designed to deal with stress. Like you developed, our genome developed on the savannah a long time ago in response to stressors that would occur, you know, once a month, once a quarter, something like that. Mm-hmm. But we're not designed to deal with the stressors that we get, you know, from checking our email inbox every morning. We're designed to have a healthy amount of stress. And you can even imagine there's a U-shaped curve where you want to find just the right amount of stress that allows you to be the most productive, allows your system to work really well, allows you to deal with a stressor and then bounce back. You don't want so little stress that you're, you know, not being of service and not contributing and not discovering your gift and sharing it with the world. But you also don't want so much stress that cortisol is running the show and leading to disrupted relationships, not being able to really deliver on your talents, and getting this wear and tear process in the body.
Can you change the way stress impacts you by how you see it? So could I change distress to eustress by viewing it differently? So for example, my wife was taking care of her grandma, who sadly passed away last week. Oh. For the last 4 months, as soon as we heard that she was unwell, she flew back to London to take care of her and be by her bedside every day. It was stressful in the sense that she didn't sleep a lot. Yeah. She didn't have, it wasn't like she was supported in the support. She was, you know, doing a lot of things with her and her family. They were all taking turns, but it was stressful for her physically, mentally, emotionally. It's her favorite person on the planet, but she was doing it as a form of showing love to a person she was trying to repay for all the gifts that she'd given her whole life. Does that change how that stress impacts her, or does it not?
Oh, it does, definitely. First, I'm really moved by this story, and I'm so sorry for her loss.
Understanding how chronic stress impacts hormonal balance is vital as we transition into discussing critical hormonal shifts throughout life. Focusing on self-responsibility and the role of lifestyle choices, the next segment reveals insightful guidance on the changes women face and how to navigate them effectively.
And then I love how you described what I think of as radical self-responsibility to look at your side of the street and to look at what you can clean up. You know, I've gone through a 12-step process with food. I used to have a very dysregulated relationship with food until I turned 40. And part of 12-step is really looking at your side of the street and cleaning it up. And another thing that we learned that was so surprising to me was that if you have to choose in a situation with someone else between guilt or resentment, you should choose guilt. Now, as a mother, that was really hard for me to do because that's not what I chose for most of my life. And yet it's a way of witnessing the way that you tend to make decisions, especially decisions that lead to resentment, that then are a signal you might need to set a boundary.
As a mother of two yourself, I wanted to ask you about the hormonal shifts that we all go through from being teenagers to 20-year-olds to 30-year-olds to 40-year-olds. What are the decades that have the biggest hormonal shifts in our lives that we're not paying enough attention to?
Yeah, well, the first decade is 10 to 20. And that's when most of us are going through puberty, if you're healthy, you're not exposed to excessive endocrine disruptors. And that's a time of a lot of volatility. So boys become men, they go through the puberty process, they start making more testosterone, their voice deepens. Women, girls go through puberty and they start to menstruate. The systems that control this, which are mostly in the brain, the hypothalamus, pituitary, and how they talk to the adrenals and also the gonads, so ovaries in women, testes in men, that system is immature, 10 to 20. Now, we often intervene in that time period which I don't agree with. So I like to give a lot of room for this control system to get set up. I'm not a big fan of giving birth control pills, as an example, to girls who have acne or regular periods or painful periods. There's so many other ways that we can work with lifestyle first to address that. So right now, millions of girls between 10 and 20 get started on birth control pills. Hopefully we'll talk more about this and why I think that is the number one hormone disruptor that we have in this country. And then if you look 20 to 30, that's the period where your control system for hormones becomes more stabilized. So women often have more regular menses. Men reach their peak testosterone. And so they often have a lot of vigor. It's why athletes, you know, I take care of NBA players. And 20 to 30 is really when they're at their peak. So performance, it's a time where you recover better from exercise. It's a great place to establish critical habits, like with food, with sleep, because if you don't sleep well, you're going to fall down a hormonal flight of stairs at some point. So that's when I think people really need to dial in some of the boring basics that really set you up for the kind of hormonal homeostasis that we're talking about. Now, in your late 20s, some hormones can start to decline, and some of us, fertility can start to decline. Egg quality, sperm quality. So 30 to 40 is when I like for people to really focus on noticing any early signals of change. So that might be in a woman looking at your day three of the cycle, estradiol and follicle stimulating hormone. FSH is one of those control hormones from the brain. Looking at your estrogen to make sure it's not too high, not too low. Looking at testosterone. So for men, they may want to check their sperm quality at that time. They may want to look at a baseline testosterone level, free and total. So that's when things start to get out of whack. And then after 40, that's when women especially start to have symptoms of perimenopause. And there's more than 100 plus symptoms associated with that. Mood swings, irritability, sleeplessness, noticing that your memory might be changing. You know, you lose your phone, you lose your keys. So perimenopause is another critical piece to think about, but there's this myth that your hormones don't change until you go through perimenopause and menopause or andropause for men. The truth is it changes decades before that. So we want to be paying attention throughout.
What was the male hormone word change? I've never heard that ever.
Andropause.
I've never heard that.
Well, I'm glad
life.
You haven't heard of it because yeah. That probably means your testosterone is good. So a lot of people call andropause male menopause, and it's when testosterone starts to decline. We're seeing this in younger and younger men.
Why?
We think it's related to stress, like the amount of stress that we're managing. We think it's also related to toxins, endocrine disruptors, things like bisphenol A is an example of something that can lower your testosterone. Being exposed to forever chemicals. I know you talked to Darshan Shah about these. When it comes to men, the hormonal change of andropause is gradual, and it can sometimes fly below the radar. Whereas for women, the change in progesterone that kicks off the start of perimenopause and then the decline in estrogen is much more sudden. So that's why it tends to trigger so many more symptoms.
I wanted to dive into something you mentioned earlier, which was around birth control, because I think this is a big topic for our community and our audience. And you mentioned there that so many teenage women get given birth control, especially for acne. Why was birth control ever given for acne or anything else that wasn't connected to birth control?
Yeah, the number of reasons that clinicians prescribe birth control pills has broadened over time. So when it was first developed, it was for contraception, and it's very effective for contraception. It's about 90% effective. You have to be a perfect user, like take it at the right time each day. But what happened was that the pharmaceutical companies that make birth control pills started to look, especially as their pills became off patent, look for other reasons to prescribe it. And I'm an OBGYN, so I was taught all these other indications besides contraception to prescribe it. So that includes acne. Why does it help with acne? Because the birth control pill raises this intermediate hormone, sex hormone binding globulin, and that drops the body's testosterone level. And that reduces acne that's related to high testosterone. Now, a lot of teenagers, women in their 20s and 30s, have breakouts, they have acne. Some of it is driven by testosterone, not all of it. And so going on the birth control pill can help. But there's also lifestyle medicine that you could do to address that. It's given for painful periods. It's another reason that makes me crazy, because we know that the reason why women have painful periods is something called prostaglandins are produced in the uterus, the muscle of the womb. And you can reduce the prostaglandins by having more omega-3s in your diet. So eating smashed fish, for instance, salmon, anchovies, mackerel, sardines, herring, all of those things help to reduce prostaglandins. And if you reduce inflammation, it can help you with painful periods.
Wait, so you're saying that women don't always have to have painful periods?
No. And this idea that pain is a normal part of being female and cycling is a myth that we totally have to bust, because it's not normal for your periods to hurt.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.